Hey, everybody, this is Pam, and you're listening to the occasional mail series called He Stutters, She Asks Him, which can be found on the blog Make Room for the Stuttering at stutterrockstar.com. And it's also freely available as a download on iTunes. So today, this content is going to be a little bit different because we're talking about stuttering, but our guest today does not stutter, but he knows a whole lot about stuttering. So I'd like to start by just saying hello. Hey, Ryan, glad to have you here. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited. So to get us formally started, could you introduce yourself, tell us who you are, where you're from, and what keeps you busy?
Sure. So my name is Ryan Geelan. I'm an independent filmmaker and chief creative officer at Believe Limited, a production company and content agency in Los Angeles, California. I've been an independent filmmaker for almost 20 years, making small films, some narrative, some documentary. And 6 years ago, I started filming My Beautiful Stutter, which is what I'm excited to talk about today.
Yeah. Wow. Exciting. Exciting. So you said you've been in the business 20 years. So what other types of, films or documentaries do you work on?
My background is in mostly narrative films. So either I would write a script or friends and collaborators back in New York City, where I first started making films, would write a script and we would go out and film it. Super low budget stuff. But it would go to film festivals and it would keep us busy and learning our craft. And then gradually over time, those films just started to become bigger and more professional. And so most recently, my producing partner, Patrick Lynch, and I made a documentary about the first person with severe hemophilia to summit Mount Everest. We do a lot of work and have a lot of clients for our agency in the hemophilia and rare disease space. And we met a guy named Chris Bombardier who was using mountain climbing to raise awareness and money for people with hemophilia around the world. Hemophilia treatment is incredibly expensive. And so in the Western world, in the more developed nations, you have access to what you need is about $500,000 of medicine to up to $1 million of medicine per year to stay alive as a person with hemophilia. Mm-hmm. And in the West, we have access to that, but around the world in developing countries, two thirds of the world does not have regular access to that medicine. And so Chris grew up in Colorado, was a world-class mountain climber because he had access to medicine his entire life. And he was able to summit Mount Everest and the seven summits, which are is the tallest peak on every continent, because he had access to medicine. And what he did with every conversation he had around it, with all the global press for it in our documentary, he said, look, I'm able to summit the highest peak in every continent because I have the medicine. Mm-hmm. Whereas my blood brothers, who don't have access to the medicine, die on average around age 10. They don't have access to this medicine. We have to do a better job getting this medicine out to the world. So my partner and I followed him for a year while he trained. We went up to the top of Everest with him. He summited Everest and, just did this extraordinary job bringing awareness about hemophilia to the world, especially to the medical world. From humble beginnings of making tiny little short films and small features for low budgets, we now have gone on and now do kind of bigger projects like Bombardier Blood, the climbing documentary, and My Beautiful Stutter, the documentary about, five kids from all over the country with stutters.
Yeah. Wow. So it sounds like you are very committed to, making narrative stories that, tell a story, but then offer like a call for action, if that's a good way to say it.
That's a perfect way to put it. I mean, our motto is that we create entertainment that creates change. And one of the things, I've learned over 20 years of doing this is the more there is a strong call to action, the more there is meaning behind the work, the more it's going to help people, the better the material gets, and the more people want to support it. The more your art can help others, the more people run in and say, well, I know this person, I know this person. Let me get your film to this person and this person. And so that's been our journey.
Yeah. Wow. So we're talking about stuttering today and the film, My Beautiful Stutter, which I had the opportunity and the privilege to watch. And I was just like, really kind of like blown away. Like, you know, how did this happen? And how did you get into all the little nuances of stuttering, especially with children and teens? So tell us, how was this born?
Yeah, well, I'm not a person who stutters. I went 35 years believing that I had never met anyone who stuttered. And then my producer, Michael Alden, who produced the King's Speech play on Broadway and on the West End in London, was familiar with Say. And he said, hey, I like some of the films you made, Ryan. Why don't you come with me to the Say Gala, their big fundraiser that they do every year, and just see if you think there's a film or a story in there that you'd like to work on. So we went to the 2014 Say Gala, and I'll never forget, it was a life-changing night because, as I said, 35 years, never believing I met anyone who stuttered. Stuttering was not even an afterthought. It literally just didn't really exist in my mind, except in those dumb viral videos that come out of singing competitions once a year where somebody struggles at home and they show you their home life stuttering. And then you see a viral video of them singing on stage and winning the singing competition, and everybody shares it and feels great. And like, that was it. That was my entire relationship to stuttering. We go to the Say Gala, this giant fundraiser. There's 500 people dressed to the nines. It's in this beautiful auditorium in New York City. The lights go down, single spotlight on stage, and this little boy walks out. He's in his little gray suit, little blue tie, you know, hair is all perfect. He's got it clutching a piece of paper in his hand, and he reads from the paper, thank you for coming to the 2014 Say Gala. But it took him 15 or 20 seconds to say it. And when he was done, he froze. He just stood there. And I realized in that moment, he was waiting to hear the laughter, the teasing, the whispered words, the head shaking, the mockery. But instead, what happened was, after 2 or 3 seconds of silence, a standing ovation. And wow. You could see in that moment, his entire being changed. He grew a foot in that moment. His shoulders rolled back. He strutted off stage. You could just, it literally, his, what he realized was that what Say, the Stuttering Association for the Young, and Taro, the founder, had been telling him, right? That it's okay to stutter. There's a world out there that is ready to let you speak the way you speak. You are worthy of love and friendship and decency. He realized in that moment that everything he had been hearing from Say and Taro was true. And that changed his entire future. And it was an earth-shattering moment for me, because I grew up being bullied from ages 8 to 12-ish, for being fat. And that's not a politically correct word, but I use it very, very purposefully, because that's the word that was used to make me feel less than. That word and its usage trained me to believe that I was not worthy of friendship or love or enjoying school or enjoying the day-to-day experiences that young people are supposed to have and enjoy. For years, that word was used against me to make me feel less than. And when I saw that opening moment of the gala, and I saw his shoulders roll back, and I saw him the entire facade of you are not worthy just fly away, I was just, it was a thunderclap moment. And it relit that fire in me that was lit when I was 8 years old and being told you're not worthy because you're fat, you are less than because of that. It relit that fire. And that fire has guided me for 6 straight years to make this film and try to bring it to the world.
Now, did you talk to that kid like after that happened, or behind stage, or, you know, like you saw this momentous change in him that you knew would probably change the rest of his life? You know, how did you acknowledge your pride about that moment with him, if you did?
I was never able to connect with him, but I've relayed this story to Taro, to everyone at Say. I've done 225 ballpark screenings of the film in the last 2 years, with Q&As afterwards with SLPs, with families of people who stutter, organizations all over the world. And I relay the story over and over and over again. But to specifically go to your question, I wasn't able to speak to this kid, but I was able to relay that story to Taro as one of the reasons, you know, one of the big reasons I wanted to make this film is I want to translate that moment for people like me, right? Because the world is comprised of way more people like me than people who stutter. And the people like me are the ones who need to see it and need to realize, wait a second, we are interrupting. Wait a second. We are casually making fun of disfluency in a way that is deeply harmful. So I relayed that story and said, look, I just want to give as many people as humanly possible that same experience. And I think if they watch this film, they'll have it.
Wow. I can remember when Say was called Our Time. So I know they, you know, there's a grand history, you know, with this and Taro's own, just his own deep commitment and compassion for kids who stutter. So when you approached Taro about doing this, how did he respond?
It took a while to get the official like buy-in to you know, go make this film, because I think wisely and understandably, for someone like Taro who's devoting your life to creating empathy for young people who stutter, the last thing you want to do is just let some random guy with a camera into your world where young people are vulnerable, especially because the young people that come in to Say are always creating. You know, they're using their voice to create art, to write, to create plays, to create spoken word pieces. You can't just let somebody waltz in and start filming, especially because most people who start on a big project don't finish it, you know, especially in the film world. And in documentary filmmaking, you know, you don't get the funding you thought you were going to get, or there's not really money to support your work, so you have to go take a day job or something else comes along. And so I imagine there were probably some false starts and just things that made Taro say, like, let's really make sure this is the guy we want to tell this story. And so basically 1 year after that first experience at the 2014 gala, we were able to start, we were able to start filming. But it took a while. It took a while to kind of get that buy-in.
And how did you get the buy-in of the kids? You know, you talked about how, you know, children and teens, you know, who stutter often compensate with other avenues of expression. I know for myself, I always spent a lot of time writing because I thought writing could be my fluent voice. It took me a long time to realize that, you know, I could still be that person that was in my head that was fluent. I could be out there and be fluent about that. So it's interesting that you mentioned that, you know, the kids were involved in a lot of, you know, artistic expression. So when the kids realized that you were going to come to their lives and, you know, tell their story, how did they react?
I think there's two pieces to that. There's basically one, Taro and Our Time and Say, you know, they had, because so much of what they do is creation, and they film it and they photograph it and they put it out to the world and they show it to the kids and their families. There was a level of awareness and comfort with cameras being around.
Okay.
You know, there had been news pieces from local New York City news to national Sunday morning shows. So there's a general vibe of the stuff we do here is captured and presented that I think helped quite a bit. But then there's the other piece of it. You know, you talked a little bit about your journey, you know, writing and being creative to sort of be yourself. I think when you say, when someone who is trusted like Taro says, look, this guy is trusted as well, I think young people who stutter are dying to talk about themselves and their journey. Especially because so much of what they're conditioned for at school is to not speak and to not be heard. Like, where do you put all that? You know, right. I think the reception I felt was, I'm glad you're here, and because we trust you, like, we have to tell you this. You have, so you can translate it for others.
Right. You know? Right. Wow. Yeah, and it's funny because you just alluded to my journey just a little bit. When I did finally find my voice after writing, which I've continued to do, I've had a blog since 2009. When I found my voice, I thought of this like novel idea that because I had never met anybody else who stuttered until I was, 40, but that includes never having met any women who stutter. So I started doing this podcast, Women Who Stutter, Our Stories, with the thought in my mind, oh, nobody's going to go for this. They don't want to have their stuttering story on the internet. But I was completely wrong, because as you're suggesting, everybody has a story. You just need to ask. So how did it happen to be five kids that you followed for the film?
Well, it started out with me basically filming months of material, and not every day, not filming all day every day, but popping in and out of, say, programs in New York City for months before meeting, probably three of the people who became main characters. And then another sort of, 6 months to a year of filming at camp and getting to know people's personal stories. And because when you start out on something like this, you essentially, there's two paths. Either you have a main character in advance and you're just going to follow their journey wherever it goes. Or in my case, you kind of do this shotgun approach of, let me just start capturing everything. And as stories become unique and specific, and this is very important, as characters emerge, you start to shrink down the area of your focus to those characters. And I use that word characters very specifically because, you've seen the film. When you meet someone like Sarah, who can articulate through amazing storytelling and great sound bites and very clear imagery when she speaks. Sarah's a born storyteller. She's just very entertaining, very sharp. Just, you just want to, whether you make a film or not, you just want to sit and like talk to her and hear what she has to say, And when you meet people like that, you sort of go like, oh, okay, let me spend a lot of time focusing over here. And so that was the journey. It was, let me meet as many of these young people as possible. And then over time through filming, and then especially through editing, you start to narrow and narrow and narrow down.
Yeah. And so you're on the West Coast, and this stuff happened on the East Coast. Did you move to the East Coast for a while, or how did you make it work?
The filming took place over 2 years. A lot of it was in New York City, which is where I started out after college. And so my partner and I have had for probably 6 or 7 years, an apartment in Bushwick, Brooklyn that we kept because we had to film in New York so often. So we would go back and forth all the time, New York, Los Angeles, and pop all over the country to where we had to film. Like, as I'm sure you saw, the main characters in the film live in five different cities around the country. So we would kind of travel all over to do the filming. And, it's interspersed. It's not like we were filming every day. So, if we would film for a week or two at a time on this documentary, we would also have to be back in LA for meetings and work and filming. And then we would go to, Kentucky to film a little for a different project. And you get kind of used to bouncing around, kind of tracking the story or going where the work takes you.
Yeah. I was so enamored with the camp, the 2 week camp experience. Because if you didn't know that the film was about stuttering, you would think, oh, this is just kids enjoying themselves, meeting each other, making new friends at a camp, swimming and sitting around the fire and roasting marshmallows and, just bonding with each other. Did you find that to be like a central theme in what you chose to put together for the final product?
Well, to specifically talk about the camp, there's one sequence that people ask me about a lot, which is the basketball sequence at camp.
Okay.
Because the basketball game has nothing on the surface, nothing at all to do with stuttering. It's just a very exciting 4 minute, 5 minute sequence where kids at camp are playing their counselors in this traditional annual, very competitive, like high energy, high stakes basketball game. And people have said to me, like, why was that in there? Why, you know, it's not about stuttering. It's just kids playing basketball. It's fun. It's exciting. But like, why? And my, that sequence to me is so important because if you are outside of the stuttering community and you believe that stutterers are to be pitied or to be aside or other than or less than, but then you see this fantastic basketball game and you see people who can actually ball. I mean, Will can play, you know, all of a sudden you think, wait a second, not only are these kids having an amazing time, but they can actually ball. They can actually play. I kind of wish I was there. The minute you get a kid who's 14, not involved in stuttering, no idea about the stuttering community, you know, maybe like is like kind of keeps, you know, wants to keep this whole thing at arm's length. That kid feels a twinge of envy. Like, oh, I wish I was, that game looks fun. The minute you can get a 14-year-old to think that, especially I was a 14-year-old boy. If you could get me to think of that, it changes my entire world, my entire perspective toward the thing I'm watching. So I wanted that game in there because I wanted young people who don't stutter to feel a little jealous. I wanted them to be like, God, this camp looks fun. I wish I could play with these kids. That looks awesome. You know, it's a nighttime basketball game. The fans are full. Everybody's cheering for, like, under the lights. I mean, so my big idea with that in particular is I want to create some envy. And I also don't want this to be a pity party. I want people to realize these are full, well-rounded individuals. They are more than just stuttering. And I just thought that would be kind of a revolutionary thing to see.
Yeah. You know, and not only would, kids that don't stutter who would be watching that basketball game, not only would they, you know, want to be part of it because it was so exciting and fun, but it also normalizes, you know, those kids that stutter that you don't really hear them stuttering because they're, playing ball, but just the whole, you know, the whole story to story normalizes stuttering for those that don't stutter. And that is so important because we just want people to see, and you said it earlier, hey, we're just like everybody else. It may just take 2 or 3 seconds longer to, you know, say what we have to say and what we want to say. Now, there was another segment that really, grabbed my emotions and, you know, kind of tugged at my heart. That was when they did the pairing of the mentors. So older kids who stutter with some of the younger kids who stutter. And that seemed to work really well. What did you think about that?
You know, it's interesting. It's kind of similar to like why the basketball sequence is in there, but it's kind of similar to why the basketball sequence is in there, because what that does when you pair the older kid who stutters with the younger kid is it gives the younger kid the firsthand experience of, wait a second, there is light at the end of the tunnel. This kid is older than me. They seem so confident. They've known these other kids at camp, or they're getting along great with these other kids at camp. They're more capable at sports because they're older and bigger and stronger and faster. They're telling me, hey, I want to hear what you have to say. You know, if you recall being that age, if an older kid took an interest in you or said, hey, you're kind of cool. Hey, I like that idea. Hey, that's funny. Like, the minute an older kid did that, you would be like, oh, maybe I am kind of cool. All right. You know, you it lifts your spirit. It gives you confidence. It gives you hope. So this, just the mere act, and I hope this came through in the filming, but the mere act of having Will talk to Malcolm and be like, hey, tell me about your life. What do you want to do? All of a sudden, Malcolm's like, well, this guy who's 6'6" and a great athlete, like I want to be a great athlete, is telling me I'm interesting and asking me questions about my future and my goals. Maybe things aren't that bad. Maybe I can kind of become him or look to him for a pathway forward. Or, you know, it's just such a confidence booster in minutes after you start talking to an older kid, but then even to go further, to walk out on stage with that older kid.
I know.
And have them say, hey, I'm with you. I'm right here next to you. And we're going to speak together. I got you. You know, I think it's just truly, truly groundbreaking. It's one of those things in the filming of it. I remember after we had filmed the WSAY evening where the kids just shared their poems and the little things they had written with their partners. I went out and just kind of cried behind that shed, and just, it was just so, so profound. And I felt like I was very, very lucky to be let into that moment, to an incredibly vulnerable moment in all these young people's lives.
Now, did these young people, you know, come to trust you enough that you were welcome in no matter what path or, you know, part of the camping situation? I mean, did they all just kind of like, oh, that's Ryan and he's got a camera, no biggie? And, you know, did you feel that welcome spirit?
Yeah, I mean, everybody and their parents were all prepped in advance that there would be, you know, more filming than usual. What they're used to at camp is a couple counselors with handy cams and a professional photographer comes. And so they're used to some level of filming, but everybody was prepped in advance that we would be there. So there were anywhere from 5 to 7 people on my team, just depending on, you know, so there were 7 of us to start. And then by the end, there were 5 because of other commitments and stuff. But you know, they knew what was taking place, and kids, you know, to go to what I said earlier, to have a trusted person there who's saying, I want to translate your experience to change the world around you in a way that you wish it would change. It just opens people up tremendously.
Yes. Yes. And you mentioned parents. So there was one day, I don't know if it was like the second to the last day or the last day, but you know, the kids' families and parents came, and some of the reactions that I saw from parents were just like mind blowing for me, because at that age, I had never had anybody to even talk about stuttering, and my family didn't acknowledge that I stuttered. So what did you, which was really difficult, of course, but what did you see with the parents that were there, and maybe in particular, first time parents that saw this kid that was different from when they'd arrived to camp two weeks earlier?
I think over the course of filming this, my wife and I've been working on this for so long. My wife and I got married, had 2 kids.
Oh, wow.
and our oldest started stuttering in the way that I think a lot of kids do, you know, 2, 3, 4 years old, where they're first learning to speak, and the stuttering can appear quite severe. And, you know, if I hadn't been making this film, I wouldn't have known that childhood stuttering either, you know, can go away by the time you're 5, 6, 7, or it can last a lifetime. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have known that the best thing any of us can do is to simply let the person speak and to be patient and empathetic. I wouldn't have known that there is an entire world out there that doesn't believe fluency is the only path of value. You know, I wouldn't have known any of that. And so I had a level of calm when my youngest started stuttering, and it has since gone away. But I wouldn't have had that if I hadn't been making the film. And there's only one of me making the film, right? So the other thing that took place in me when my youngest started, I promise I'm getting to the answer to your question. But the other thing that started taking place in me that I think, even having worked on the film for so long, when my oldest started stuttering, is I started to get very anxious and protective. And I started to think to myself, what do I need to do to help him, to make sure nobody bullies him, to make sure nobody makes him feel less than for this? And you know, he was 2.5, 3 years old. I cannot imagine the difficulty as a parent when you come from a place of love and all you want is, you know, when my kid is sick, I think to myself every minute of every day, I just give me the cold. just give it to me. Don't let me take it from you. You know, I read a story the other day about a boy with hemophilia in the 80s whose father said to him, I wish I could give you my legs. So, and I could take yours because I don't need them. I don't want them anymore. I want you to have fresh legs because the boy with hemophilia kept having these awful bleeds that had him in a wheelchair. And like when there is something that is hurting your kid or causing them challenges that they didn't ask for, all you want as a parent is to take it away. Mm-hmm. You would run through fire to take it away. And that's what I saw. I saw parents who didn't know in a lot of cases that fluency isn't the only pathway or the only solution or the only life that's okay, you know? And that what that leads to is a range of approaches. In the parents group that's captured in the film, you see the approaches range from, hey, we've been with Say for a long time, so we know that fluency isn't the only approach. We know that it's okay to stutter and our family life has improved because we are just so focused on letting our child know that they are worthy of love, whether they become 1% more fluent or not, right? That's all the way on one end of the spectrum. And on the other end of the spectrum, I focus some time in the film on Mark and Melanie because Mark, as a parent, believes the opposite. He's on the other end of the spectrum where true fluency is the only victory, at least in that point in their lives, right? And the reason Mark and Melanie play such a big role in the film is because they are on the other end of the spectrum. And it's causing, from my point of view, and from what they talk about in the film, pain. The belief that, you know, their belief that fluency is the only path to success and victory and the only win is causing, I think, ongoing pain that doesn't need to be there. And the reason I focus on Mark, especially when there are a few other parents and relationships that could highlight this, is it's so clear to me that Mark loves his family with all of his heart. And yet I believe is still making the wrong decision that is causing continued problems. And I wanted to highlight that for audiences, both in the stuttering community and out. You can come from a place of true, 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 perfect, wonderful parental love and still be adding to the problem instead of subtracting from it, right, from my point of view. So I know that's a bit of a long answer, but this idea of being a parent and how do you deal with a child's stutter? How do you empower your child to deal with their stutter is a huge, huge challenge. But I also think it's a huge opportunity because if Tara's philosophy, if Say's philosophy can really, really take root, then parents will not pressure SLPs to make my child fluent. Yeah. Parents will not pressure children to do the strategies over and over and over again to become 5% more fluent.
Right.
Parents will instead, from minute one, say to their kids, hey, I just want you to know, no matter what, if you never become 1% more fluent, ever, you are worthy of everything. Mm-hmm. You are worthy of love. You are worthy of friendship. You are worthy of positive experiences. You are worthy of joy. I need you to know that. And if we can get parents to start there, and therefore SLPs to start there, if we can get everyone to start there, this idea that young people who stutter are predestined to struggle or to predestined to have mental health challenges, to predestined to have self-esteem challenges goes away.
Right.
If we can get everyone to start with, no matter what, you are worthy. Mm-hmm. I think it could be a complete paradigm shift. And that's why I've treated this film as a mission instead of just a movie. Mm-hmm. The film and getting it out to the world is a mission for me and not a movie.
Mm-hmm. Now, where has the film played? You mentioned something about, non-stuttering communities. Has it played to largely fluent audiences?
That's a great question. So we've done, in the last 2 years, we've done a little over 225 screenings. Mm-hmm. And they were in person for a year. And for the last year, they've been virtual, obviously. And they've been literally all over the world, something like 20, 25 countries. The organizations that have booked screenings, so it's been film festivals for a while, but then the organizations that have booked screenings have ranged from SLPs booking a screening for their practice and their colleagues, mm-hmm. all the way to stuttering organizations, anti-bullying organizations, teachers groups, film clubs. It has branched out. I would say half the audience over the last 2 years has been people who stutter and, probably 2/3 of the audience, people who stutter and speech language pathology groups. Mm-hmm. Asha and Nisla have been enormous supporters of the film. They did a screening for 350 SLPs in 2019. That was the same year that they gave Taro the Annie Glenn Award for his work at SEI. And Nisla has, I think Nisla organizations on, you know, grad school campuses around the country have done over 60 screenings, I think, at this point.
Wow.
And the conversations have been extraordinary. The conversations have been really, really wonderful. There's a desire to learn. There's a desire to talk about the film. But today, as of 12 days ago, 13 days ago, we're very lucky to be distributed by Discovery Channel. So Discovery Channel has a new streaming app called Discovery Plus. Their entire Discovery Channel family of shows is on there. And we're Discovery Original. We're one of the first original documentaries released through Discovery Plus. So just like anywhere you would, you know, your smart TV or Apple TV or Roku, you can download the Discovery Plus app. There's a 7-day free trial. Download it and watch the film. And it's going to be exclusive there for 6 years. It'll be on Discovery Plus for 3 years at least. And then in September, the film becomes available on iTunes, Amazon, on DVD, and various other places around the world.
Wow. In wind down mode, let's talk about Taro. What did you find from Taro that, you know, gives him this deep drive and sense of purpose? I mean, how did he come to do this?
Taro tells a really powerful anecdote toward the end of the film. Once you've seen him work for a while, we reveal kind of what triggered this for him. He was an actor. He was, you know, booking work and you know, enjoying himself, but really struggling with his disfluency. And he tells a story about, you know, we're talking to his grandparents on the phone and not being able to say the name of the play that he was performing in. And he says he's 26 years old, and he sat in a closet and couldn't get the words out. And he said it was a terrible, terrible block. And he was yanking on the clothes above him in the closet. And when he was done, he said it was just so uncomfortable and kind of humiliating for him. You know, he hadn't done this in front of anybody. It was just on an interpersonal level. Mm-hmm. He realized he was sitting in a closet covered in clothes that he had yanked off the rack. He was hiding, like truly physically hiding. And it was all because he was trying to hide the fact that he stuttered. You know, his entire life had been spent hiding it. And I think in that moment, he made a really powerful decision that he was going to try not to hide it. And he was going to try to help others feel the same way, to feel worthy of love, you know, as they are, as you are, not because you are more fluent than the next person or because you've achieved fluency. And I just think it's a really, really powerful, profound story. You know, that's kind of how the world changes when someone decides they have to change the world for themselves. And then they start looking around and they realize, you know, there are a lot of other kids like me, and nobody is telling them this. Nobody is letting them know this, you know, no matter how much people, you know, every SLP in the country, everyone I've spoken to in 225 screenings of this film wants to empower young people. They want to do the right thing. They want to listen. They want to be a safe space for kids with disfluency, mm-hmm. you know, but they just, no one has told them fluency doesn't have to be the answer.
Right.
You know? And so I think Taro made a really profound decision. And once you realize that, how do you stop? You know, right. Once you realize that you can change the world for kids who stutter, you don't stop working on that. You know, you can't turn your back on those kids anymore. And so I think that was Taro's journey.
Wow. I didn't know that. So I was just really, you know, interested in, you know, where this all began. And, you know, it's just really a beautiful story, as was the film. So last question, what is it from the film that you want people to take from?
The one word answer is empathy. And I think for parents who see it, I hope that their empathy is triggered in a way that makes them realize their child needs to know that the way they speak is beautiful. And if you never become even 1% more fluent, it will not change how I feel about you. Mm-hmm. I think for SLPs who see it, if their empathy is triggered, I think the question they should ask themselves every day is, how do I make my practice a place where the child's armor can come off? How do I make my practice a safe haven instead of a place where maybe they feel like the armor has to stay on, mm-hmm. you know, because they believe that I'm going to be disappointed maybe if they're not fluent. Mm-hmm. For kids who stutter, I hope they just see the film as a touchstone. I hope that if they feel isolated and alone, they know that they can in a moment when they need it, turn the film on and be reminded that there's a bunch of us out here fighting for them, and that they're not alone, that there are other kids who are living the exact same journey. And I hope that when they turn the film on, they realize, okay, there are some adults out there with power, with a voice, with a megaphone, who are all fighting on my behalf. Mm. You know, because I that's how I see myself. I see myself fighting on behalf of, you know, a 10-year-old in the middle of the country who believes no one else in the world stutters, who believes that because they can't get more fluent, they're a failure of some kind. Mm. I hope that they're like, wait a second, there's, you know, that's one of the reasons I'm so happy that we ended up on a Discovery Channel property, because people go to Discovery Channel to be intellectually stimulated. Mm-hmm. It has credibility, and it has global credibility. So for a kid who stutters, you know, they're not having to like dig this out of, you know, some YouTube search results. Right. It's literally like on Discovery, mm-hmm. you know? And so I just am very, very happy that that's what they might find. I'm sorry, that's probably a longer answer than you're looking for.
Nope. This is good stuff. And I fibbed. I do have one more question. So the kids that were, you know, part of A Beautiful Film, have they seen it? And how did they react?
Yeah, so we let Say do sneak preview screenings at their camps every year. So they've seen various cuts of the film. They've seen, many of them have seen it multiple times. They love it. They love it. You know, everybody likes to be featured on, you know, even if it was just a rinky-dink video that you filmed in passing. And I think they feel pretty honored by it, you know, I hope.
I'm sure they do. And I feel honored to have had you on the show today. I'm sure that many, many people, both fluent and stuttering, who are going to hear this podcast are going to feel very inspired. So thank you so much for being a guest and just being so open and talking about the who, what, and why of how this came to be.
My pleasure. Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And this has been He Stutters, She Asks Him.